You are listening to the Punk News Podcast, and today I've got literally one of my all-time favorite guests, one of my all-time favorite interview subjects. I would say probably the most fascinating guy I've ever interviewed, and I've interviewed Lee Scratch Perry. I've interviewed Joan Jett, who's actually way more fascinating than you might think. I've interviewed David Johansen, but I think this guy is probably the most fascinating guy I've ever interviewed ever. We've got Eugene Robinson of Buñuel, Eugene of Oxbow, Eugene of Whipping Boy. And I'm going to tell a quick story, and then we're going to say hi to Eugene, and then we're going to play a song. This kind of sums up to me Eugene. The first time I interviewed Eugene, and the first time I met him, I said, Eugene, let's do an interview. And he said, okay, well, I'm practicing MMA in Palo Alto. So I drove over to Palo Alto in California. I mean, I was in California. And I think he was already inside the gym. And I walk inside the gym, and it's like four or five or six like super MMA guys, like MMA guys that do MMA like all the time. And Eugene sees me, and he's like, I'm going to practice, and then we can do the interview afterwards. So I say, okay. And so I sit on like one of these giant tractor tires they use for like flipping practice or whatever, or calisthenics, or however you want to phrase it. And Eugene puts in a Bad Brain CD in a portable CD player. It was either the Roar cassette tape or Rock for Light. I forget which. And the guy who's about to start practicing with, he says, what is that, devil's music again, Eugene? And I always thought that was funny because Bad Brains is the polar opposite of devil's music. So I thought that was kind of funny. And then Eugene and the guy practicing MMA, and Eugene just batters the guy. I mean, like, he's not like breaking noses or breaking arms, but they're like grappling or whatever. And Eugene just slamming this guy around for 40 minutes. And I was just thought that was like, what's that? Devil's music? And Eugene just wrecks the guy. Then we go outside, and Eugene's got like something like a Chevelle or something. Eugene, what was that really cool vintage car you had? Was that a Chevelle or something?
1965 Chevy Chevelle. Yep.
Yeah, and then he's got this gigantic junkyard dog in the back, although I think the dog was actually pretty nice. And this
Popeye.
Dog goes out.
Yeah, my Popeye, yeah.
And then Eugene, after just whipping the crap out of this guy, after pulling out this huge junkyard dog, Eugene is the most literate, self-aware person I think I've ever interviewed. So that's Eugene to me. Eugene, we're going to play a brand new song from your brand new album by not a brand new band, but a band that's been around a little while, Buñuel. The new album
is called Buñuel.
Yep. It's called Mansuitude. It's on October 25. It's a double LP, three sides, and CD and tape as well. And this is Fixer, and it also has a guest appearance from the young lady from Couch Slut, Megan from Couch Slut. And let's play it right now. We'll be right back.
shoe.
And we are back. Eugene, sorry for the extended intro, but and I hope I didn't gush too much, but I want to...
Nah, man. Hey, flattery will get you everywhere, man.
So Eugene really is a fascinating... So overall, Eugene, how are you feeling right now in October 2024? Are you feeling great? Are you feeling bad? Are you feeling on the fence? How are you feeling right now?
I just wrote a Substack about it. I don't know if you read my Substack, Look What You Made Me Do, a title I started using before Taylor Swift. But I said I've gotten into this preternatural concept of ease. Like, I don't know what happened. After this summer of turmoil, I just feel comfort and ease. And it's been unshakable. I've been just all right with everything. And it may not last a long time. The last time I felt this way, it lasted 8 months. But right now, I feel okay about pretty much everything. So,
well, and if the listeners don't know, Eugene's got an awesome Substack, which you should read. It's eugenesrobinson.substack.com. Yep. And actually that leads off to our first real question is, one of my favorite ever Substack entries was Eugene used to work at this company called Ozzy. And he talks about how he had this boss, Carlos Watson. And it's this crazy story where Eugene says something. And I'm going to summarize. Like, Eugene says, I'm going to take PTO on August 26th because I got a speaking engagement. And then, like, on August 25, his boss is like, Eugene, we need you to come in on Saturday, August 26th, to talk about something. And Eugene's like, but I've got a speaking engagement and I've got a PTO. And he's like, we need you to come in, Eugene. So Eugene, like, has to cancel speaking engagement. He goes in, his boss, Carlos Watson, says, oh, you look tired, go home, we'll talk about it on Monday. And I don't know how Eugene can strangle the guy, which, knowing Eugene, he could have. So anyways, Eugene has a lot of resentment towards this guy. And it turns out that Eugene wasn't at the center of, but he was cursorily involved in a crazy financial fraud thing where Carlos Watson and another guy contacted Goldman Sachs and had a meeting with Goldman Sachs. But one of the other guys at Ozzy used a voice – this sounds like out of sci-fi – used a voice manipulator to act like he was a guy from Wells Fargo. No, from YouTube.
Act like it was a guy from YouTube, yeah.
And actually, well, you briefly tell the story, and then that's going to lead off to my first question. But go ahead.
All right. So Samir Rao was the chief operating officer, uses a voice changing device as Carlos Watson coaches him through a $40 million finance call with Goldman Sachs, a company where these two Harvard grads both used to work. I mean, it doesn't stand a chance of working at all. They're immediately pegged as using a voice changing device. The Goldman Sachs people get off the phone. They call the guy that's supposed to be at YouTube. He says, I wasn't in any meeting. And at that point, the shit hit the fan. And Ben Smith from the New York Times got involved, busted it wide open. The guy was on trial, convicted a few weeks ago, and is now looking at 37 years in prison. And of course, they screwed me over in the process. They could have had me sign an NDA and a non-disparagement clause, but they decided to screw with my money, denied me the money. So I've been talking about it ever since, much to my great delight. I've written a few articles on it, one for the New York Times, one for Alta Magazine, and one for this podcast to TV documentary that's coming up. If ever you have had a chance to give your boss what he deserves, this is an object lesson in it. It's really wonderful.
And actually, we're already going off track, but that's all right. In that, Eugene, so rarely in life do you feel like bad people really get their comeuppance? You know, do they really feel like justice is truly served? And now this guy might only get a year or whatever, but he might get 30 years or whatever. How's it
feel? Well, the minimum is 2 years. And the best part is when he was convicted, you know, he was assuming that he was going to be released on bail. He was such an ass during the trial that they remanded him to custody. So he spent about 4 weeks or 5 weeks at MCD, which used to be, in my mind, I think it was the Brooklyn House of Detention. And this guy was not cut out for it at all. They had to put him in solitary because he was having problems with his convicted killer cellmate. So in a lot of ways, I feel majorly vindicated, you know.
Imagine, like, literally flying around the world in a personal jet or whatever, and then you're in the slammer with just some dude. You know what I mean? That's got to be quite the trip.
Yeah, man.
How does it feel, Eugene, to like have your asshole boss really, really hit the rocks real bad? Like, that must be great, right?
I wish all of you within the sound of my voice would live long enough to feel the kind of Schadenfreude, the joy that I feel at having a really, really bad guy get what was coming to him. It's not, like you say, it's not often in life that you get that to happen, and I'm glad to have survived to see it. He's a horrible human being, and I don't feel bad about saying so.
So that time period kind of kicks off, I guess, a chain of events leading up to this moment in Eugene's life, because a few years ago, I don't want to say Oxbow reactivated, but Oxbow became active again. And then Oxbow ended relatively abruptly just a few months ago. So, Eugene, are you feeling battered and beaten? Are you feeling, I'm stronger than ever, I've walked through fire, and here I am with Boonwell, my latest project? So how are you feeling tough as ever? Are you feeling wounded? How are you feeling?
I feel pretty great, man. You know, I mean, the thing is, I often said that I viewed the first Oxbow record through Thin Black Duke, in my mind, was one record, right? It was a single record. And in other words, I had all I needed to say said by Thin Black Duke. And we deviated for Love's Holiday, where usually I would give the lyrics first and then they would write the music to the lyrics. This time they had music first and I wrote lyrics to the music. And as it turned out, it seemed to be a meditation on love, hence the name Love's Holiday. The second record in the cycle was Follow Me Now in Merry Measure, has just got finished, like, you know, right before we left on tour. I did the last bit of vocals. But, you know, in tone and in timbre, these were different from the first batch of songs. I was interested in where they were going to go, but I didn't have the same sort of emotional investment. So to have it end the way it did feels like, you know, I mean, yeah, we're deeply in debt. Yeah, we're not going to get a chance to serve this record. Yeah, we missed the show with Metallica in Clisson, France, as part of Hellfest, which would have been pretty great. Yeah, we got the last four shows of the tour canceled. You know, yeah, it ended in a cloud of, you know, despair. I mean, that's not how you want to end a 36-year engagement. But at the same time, like people say about jobs, you're either going to leave it or you're going to die doing it. And, you know, I'm glad to be able to not die doing it. So.
Well, I will say what's cool about, Eugene, I'm going to pronounce it wrong one more time. You're going to correct me. Boonwell. Named after the famous Spanish film director or movie maker. Yes. What's cool about this new record particularly, I mean, there's a few other Boonwell records, is what's really cool about this one feels, I mean, you really sound revved up, psyched, maybe a little looser, a little bit more, I feel like this one, you feel totally engaged and ready, like just, what's what I'm looking for? It feels raw and excited. That's what I'm saying.
Well, the thing is with Oxbow, a friend of ours used to, one of the guitar players in Whipping Boy, a guy, Bart Thurber, used to, I think he played one or two shows with Chuck Berry. And at one point he was asking for like, hey, where's the set list? Where are we? And Chuck Berry just looked at him. He goes, what do you mean? And he's like, what songs are we playing? And Chuck Berry just kind of looked at him like he was confused. He goes, Chuck Berry songs. It's like, you know, if you can't figure it out, get the fuck out. So, I mean, Oxbow had gotten to the point where we very clearly understood that what we played was Oxbow music, right? We weren't trying to sound like anybody but Oxbow. So that's great. And it's great to be in the position to have that happen. But it also doesn't leave, it demands of me as a vocalist certain specific things. Whereas with Boonwell, it doesn't demand anything of me. We're still trying to figure out what Boonwell music is and inviting you, the listener, along for a ride. So yeah, it was, I was using my voice in a way that I don't usually use it. It was a callback to certain things that I liked, that I wanted to do better and different. And your characterization is 100% on. I listened to the record, and if it was a good record, I would just say, it's a good record, you know, but it's actually a great record. And I think just everybody really delivered well on it, so.
What's interesting to me is the two tracks released so far are friggin' savage, especially, well, I mean, they're both savage, but Fixer is especially savage. But the new album is called Mansitude, which means meek or kind of gentleness. Is that an ironic? First of all, I honestly, Eugene, I didn't even know this was an English word, mansitude. I'd never heard of this word ever. Did you like go searching for this word, or are you so literate that you use this word like in everyday language? You know.
Well, I'm literate enough to use the word often, but I don't use it. I've used it in written language. I haven't used it in spoken language, you know. And it was, we had a bit of the record before, the Boonwell record before was called Killers Like Us. And we had a bit of internal controversy because, you know, these cats are all Italian. So the vibe and the zeitgeist is a little bit different when I give them the artwork for it, which is, you know, a Model 29 Magnum 44 on my kitchen table. And they're like, nah, bro, we're not feeling it, you know. So I said, this is what it's got to be. It's, you know, this is a trilogy, you know, it matches the lyrical content, it matches the first two records. It's what it is, man. So they fundamentally ended up agreeing, but then I thought, you know what, they're sort of right to the extent that I want to have it a clear cut demarcation between the first three and this one. And a good way to do that is through a title that no one can pronounce for a word that people rarely use. So that's how we ended up with Mansitude.
When you're writing lyrics, how spontaneous is it, or how structured? Like, do you go through like line by line, say, oh, I want this word or this word? Or when you're writing lyrics, do you just like spit it out and it's just what jumps out of your throat?
You know what, my mom used to have a saying, and her saying was, my first mind is my better mind, which of course is just a Buddhist concept, you know, Zen Buddhist concept. And with the other records, we did it like Oxbow did our Love's Holiday, and then the record that's unreleased. They pretty much gave me music, and then I wrote lyrics to the music. This one that we're working on, because of course we're working on the record after Mansitude, they've done something that we've deviated, and they said, well, give us some lyrics before, so we get a sense of where you'd like to go with this. So I gave them, I think, two or three lyrics about where, you know, kind of where my head is at. But usually I do it like not stream of consciousness, but like automatic writing, you know. And I don't belabor it. I sit there and let the idea explain itself to me, you know. And I'm just kind of like a court reporter, a stenographer for you know, a prevailing idea. And you know, my obsessions, if you paid attention to the music that I've written over the last since 1980, my obsessions are pretty clear cut, you know. So us at our worst is pretty much going to be the lyrical field of play for me.
There's a pretty cool set of guests on this record. You've got Jacob from Converge, you've got Dwayne of Jesus Lizard, and you've got Megan of Couch Slut. And I know a lot of the young people, namely Punk News editor and Moore, who's like 22. She's a huge Couch Slut fan, and she was, I don't know if she knew a whole lot about Eugene, but she was a Couch Slut fan, and that combo like made her a big Eugene fan, both Oxbow and Boonwell. I guess people might have been surprised by having Megan of Couch Slut. I mean, I would say the Jesus Lizard combo, that makes sense, you know, kind of, you know, the noise rock background, if you will. And of course, Converge, Jacob, he's always around. But how did you link up with Megan? Have you been a fan? I mean, that band's about 10 years old now, I guess. Are you a fan of Couch Slut, or how'd that link up happen?
Well, I love everybody in that band, specifically, as well as Megan. But you, and of course, this is a factoid, a fun fact. Their name is derived from an Oxbow song, right? Mm-hmm. You know this. Off of The Snake and the Stick, off of An Evil Heat, there's the intro, and the line is, you know, I got couch sluts of every stripe, the boys and the girls and those in-between types. And when I saw the name Couch Slut, I was like, there's no way that didn't come from an Oxbow song. And I've watched there and listened to them with great interest prior to, and then in a strange turn of events, some guy writes a story for me when I'm at Ozzy. And the story is about being gaslit by some woman and she's making fun of him, blah, blah, blah. So I go, great story. I publish it. I pay the guy, whatever, $100 for it. I get an email from some woman who goes, you don't know me, but this guy wrote about me, and he's nuts and full of shit. And it turns out that was Megan. And she goes, also, I don't know if you know, I've got a band that's derived from one of your song lyrics. So then I'd already been listening to them, already liked them. And I was like, oh my God, I love you guys. And, you know, I said, if you want to write a rejoinder to this guy's piece, She goes, I don't know if I want to do that and out myself or whatever. But then they ended up playing with in 2023, they played support for us for a bunch of shows that we had done, I think in Philly and some other places. So it was great to actually see them live, to get that, you know, to know them better. And it was a no-brainer. I think I'd asked Julie Christmas before, because we go way back, and she was like, yeah, you know, I mean, and also there was this pent-up demand, because that was a feature I always liked to do with Oxbow, but then I got a lot of resistance from members of Oxbow going into kind of Love's Holiday, where, you know, I mean, the people, we had guest artists on Love's Holiday, but none of those were people that I had chosen. So there, my people were kind of, there was pushback on my people. I was like, okay, fine. I had from Fuckfest to Thin Black Duke, my shots, so whatever. So when I got this Mansitude, I go, I want to work with people. And these were all people who I really loved and loved their vocals and guitar playing with Dwayne Dennison. And I was actually like a high school kid. Like I was very shy about asking, weirdly enough, because I love these guys so much and didn't want them to say no. So whether it was Jake or Megan, and Megan said, I mean, you know, it's a possibility. She said, yeah, I love Oxbow too, but if the record comes out on such and such label, can't do it because I hate those fucking guys. So I'm like, no, it's not that label. And she goes, are you sure? I go, no, I'm not a liar. Not lying to you. It's not that label. So she agreed. Jake agreed, like, you know, sight unseen, because I've never done a lot of vocals with another dude. So I wanted to do that. And Dwayne Dennison, as a fun fact, I had done the liner notes for Gang of Four. And they were looking for a guitar player to go on tour on this big fancy box set that they did. And I was really pushing hard for it to be Dwayne from Jesus Lizard. And I went to him first and said, this is what I'm doing. Would you do this if they asked? He goes, I would do it in a second. So I pushed and pushed and pushed and pushed. They chose somebody else. But I think the fact that I was, you know, pushing for him made him feel kindly toward us. And he was glad to play guitar on it.
Well, very cool. We've got a lot to talk about, but let's play another song. And of course, the new song, this song is off Mansitude, the new album by Moonwell.
And this is Drug Burn, and we'll be right back.
Because I'm in, as in, because And we are back. Eugene, there's so much I want to talk to you about, but let's see. Let me pick and choose first of all. Let's talk about – you talked about how you were kind of scared – or not scared, but hesitant to ask Megan. I'm always interested in what Eugene thinks of Eugene, in that, like, some people think they're the – let's use – I'm a huge fan of KRS-One. And we don't really know what KRS-One thinks of himself deep down, but he's always like, I'm the best, the greatest MC. And honestly, to me, he is the greatest MC. He's amazing live. He's always ultra confident. And then you have some other guys like Nick Blinko of Rudimentary Peni, who's like scared to talk to people in general because he's got some issues, you know. Eugene, I mean, if you ask me, like, Eugene's the friggin' man. He kicks ass musically. He kicks ass physically. He kicks ass literally. I mean, literary and literally. And he's just a super interesting guy that has achieved an insane amount. Eugene, what's your on your scale, on your level of awesomeness from 1 to 100, where do you place yourself?
Oh, I place myself in the perfect position of 100, man.
Oh, okay.
And I mean, I'm not shy about that because, you know, I can't think of anybody else who I would rather be than me. You know, I mean, that's why I always thought that Chris Rock routine, when he's talking to his audience, he's going, "You don't want to trade places with me, and I'm rich." You know, he's talking about this whole white, you know, that lame kind of comedian, white people, black people thing. Oh, you white people, you wouldn't even trade places with me because I'm rich. It's like, no, we don't want to trade places with you because you're Chris Rock. You know, but I've been, I told somebody in a recent Substack, I was saying that everything that I aspired to be when I was a kid, I have managed to be. Right. And I knock on wood when I say that. But, you know, barring serious health issues, I was able to hold on to a vision of who it is that I was and actually, you know, embrace it, enact it and embody it. And at one point, Booby, I don't know if you remember, Booby used to be the drummer for that hardcore band Anti-Warfare. And he ended up becoming a doctor of Chinese medicine, had 3 or 4 like acupuncture clinics. Was doing like acupuncture for MDC and, you know, acupunctures of the stars. He was like, "Hey, man, don't you think we sold out?" And I go, "What? Because we didn't end up dead with a needle in our arms on the Lower East Side?" No. This is what hardcore has promised and we've delivered on, you know, being kind of like the military, being all you can be. Yeah, I have one professional mistake that I regret. I never should have left Apple computer when I left after a year and a half to go to Adobe, but that's a minor league deal. That's my B team, C team concern, right? Those were just jobs I did to pay the rent and to make some money, so I didn't starve to death. But I'm pretty happy with how I've ended up. I mean, and I've gone through a life misery. There've been deaths, you know. If you read the memoir that I wrote, there's a lot of unpleasant stuff there, but I still, at this point in time, I feel, you know, my kids love me. I love my kids. I got good, stabilized friendships, good relationship with their moms. You know, I got no complaints, man.
Yeah, Eugene referenced his fantastic memoir, A Walk Across Dirty Water and Straighten Your Murderer's Row Out on Farrell House, and it covers Eugene's birth through the very beginning of Oxbow. I particularly liked reading about his days in the early DC hardcore scene, his days in New York where he used to deliver food to Andy Warhol, and his days living in a shack out back in Stanford or something like that. So Eugene's got some pretty cool stories in that book. So definitely check that on out. Well, Eugene, I'm glad to hear you have a very positive opinion of yourself. So then why were you hesitant to ask Megan to be on the album? Why isn't it Megan's lucky for me to ask her to be on the album? You know what I mean?
No, because, you know, I'm also a hair trigger guy. So if I really love somebody and then they're going to, like, deny me, it's like that great line from Pulp Fiction Kill Bill, where he goes, you know, I'm a contract killer. When I get upset, what do you think is going to happen? So it's the same kind of deal. But at this point now, my time, time to trigger, you know, TTT is very short. Like, I'll flip out and then 30 seconds later, I'll be fine, you know, but I just assume skip that flip out. You know, if I could skip the flip out, I think I'm going to be healthier and better in the long run. So, and the people, you know, like Julie Christmas, she turned me down because she says, I envision us doing something together, but I want it to be something just for us. And I go, so what she's saying is this song just for us? Or is it a song that you wrote that you think I'd be good on? And it was a latter, you know, it was a song that was written and I thought she'd be good on it. So she's going to pass until there's something right for just us. But Megan was willing to jump right in there. And, I loved it. It's great. I couldn't have asked for a better contribution, you know.
With regards to Boonwell, is it a collaboration or is it like Danzig the band where you're the boss and the other guys do what you say? Or is it like
I hate that. I absolutely, the reason why Boonwell has lasted as long as it did is because those guys, they're in larger bands, you know, more significant bands locally, region, like the guitar player's connected to the guy who signed Maneskin. That I don't know, you got to be young to know who Maneskin is, but I think they just opened for the Rolling Stones, these Italian kids. So, you know, they're in much larger bands. Totally pro, like the guys are sponsored by, you know, music instrument companies, and so for them, they expected me to be like this crazy hardcore, like punk, out of control guy, and they were pleasantly surprised that when you're dealing with me, I'm about business, you know, no drama business, and they've just made it super comfortable and easy for me to do it from afar. And then, you know, I'm moving to Spain next year, so it'll be even easier when, you know, we've gone through a few bass players, but that has to do with, you know, an Italian band, say, trying to play like we play in the States, by which I mean, if you tour Italy, you play a show, a few days go by, you play another show, you tour leisurely, because you can't, how many shows are you going to get out of Italy? But when you open it up to call all of Europe, or like Boonwell is going to tour the States in the spring, we do it Oxbow style, which is 17 days, 17 shows, and no days off. So, you know, that's kind of what resulted in going through the first bass player and the second bass player. So we got a third one. But those guys are game, and they've made it pretty easy and comfortable for me to be involved, which I really appreciate.
Well, I'm super psyched for the USA Boonwell tour. You mentioned something that a lot of American bands or some American bands talk about that you don't hear from European bands. And I wonder if it's just a pragmatic issue or what is that like? I know Mike Watt is like when because he's got an Italian band too, El Sogno dei Marinaio. Yep. When they tour USA, he's like, we do it USA style. You know, 40 shows in 40 days. They're not used to that, you know. And a lot of American bands are big on, we tour nonstop, no days off. Melvins are kind of like that too, you know.
It was funny. We ran into McCluskey at one point when Oxbow did, and they were playing like two or three shows with us, and they were like two or three shows in a row, and the guys at McCluskey were going, this is crazy. You played four shows in a row. We're exhausted. And we were already, this was like our 6-week tour. We were already like 18 shows in. Like, what are these guys talking about? It's the four shows. Come on, you know? And so now I hear that McCluskey is back. I'm like, I wonder if they're doing more than four shows in a row. You know, I mean, you do what you do what you're comfortable with, you know? But if I'm going to be away from home and away from the people I love and having to pay for shit to keep my life afloat, pay rent, then I don't get paid on a day off. I don't get free food on a day off. I don't get a free hotel on a day off. I'm not paying to do this. So, you know, we got to play every day.
Yeah, actually, you bring up a great point. It used to be, you know, in the 90s or whatever, a lot of bands were like, if you're doing it for money, you're doing it for the wrong reason. Now that no band's getting paid anything, that concept has sort of faded away, you know. But
no band's getting paid anything for the recorded music that they sell. However, at this point, you know, the only real money that's being exchanged is when you play live, right? So.
Well, to that end is how much does money influence your decision-making when it comes to artistic projects? Because sadly, now that, you know, money is shorter for bands or whatever, that becomes a bigger and bigger factor, you know? So do you just make art and you're like, boy, I hope this makes money? Or do you say, I could do A, B, or C, and C is going to make more money, so I'll do C, not A and B.
How did that work, man. No. There's no hope anymore. Forget about that. I mean, listen, I got three kids I put through college, and you know, I got I'm not 19. You know, when I was in college, I had my room paid for and my food paid for. I mean, I had financial aid, and it took me until I was 33 to pay it all back. But fundamentally, I had time and I had some resource. But after that, yeah, man, I got one more kid left to put through college. And if it doesn't make dollars, it doesn't make sense. I kind of think about the old blues guys, whereas at least promise me it'll break even. That's it. That's all. That means that, you know, I got to pay for my life back home. With the money I make on the road, it's got to pay for itself at the very least, and I'm all right with that. We would always ask record labels, how are we doing with records? Not because we cared about getting the money from the records, but because if the trend lines went up, it meant that it made sense to do what we were doing. But if the trend lines were going to go down, it means it didn't make sense. You know, Chuck Dukowski once told me, he said, yeah, if there are three people in the audience, fuck it, you play like you play your ass off because it's not their fault that nobody else showed up. However, I'm not traveling 6,000 miles anymore to play to three people. I've done it once and I don't need to do it again. And if people would rather do something else with their time, you know what? So would I. So there is a loose calculation not to make oodles of money because nobody I know who makes music is living off of that music. I mean, you know this, the guys in, I used to know well, the guys in Neurosis, you know, Steve Von Till's a school teacher, you know, the guys in Converge, they've got everybody I know who's in a larger band. They all have jobs outside of the music. Right. So I guess maybe the guy, well, I met a couple of guys from Lamb of God, like they don't have outside jobs, you know, or the guys in Mastodon don't have outside jobs. Matt Pike doesn't have an outside job, but they also tour like monsters. Right. So, you know. But hope no. And I know Buzz is a gardener. I don't know if he does it for fun or because he needs to, or because he needs the health insurance, but you know, that's a little known fact. He was gardening for my friend in LA, Alan McDonald. So, I wish I could make it as a gardener. I'm a writer. That's how I make my money. So,
this has nothing to do with anything, but you mentioned Lamb of God. And Eugene, you can take a pass on this question. Well, so if you recall, the singer of Lamb of God, his name escapes me. He Randy. Played a show. Yes, he played a show in, like, was it the Czech Republic or somewhere?
Yeah, where in Prague.
Where someone jumped up on stage and died, and then he came back to the Czech Republic like 5 years later, and they arrested him and they put him on trial for either third degree murder or. And to me, it was a total shakedown. But he actually voluntarily went back to the country for a trial. And I interviewed the guitar player from Lamb of God, and I was like, you know Mark. What, man, Mark, I was like, you know what, I wouldn't have gone back at all because Czech Republic is not America, and even America might not be America, you know. But you might not get a fair trial, and I don't know what you get out of going back to a country where it might be a kangaroo court, even though you know you're innocent. And he got really mad at me. He's like, well, oh, go ahead.
I mean, I've traveled enough so that, you know, I mean, Prague, the Czech Republic is sophisticated, man. This is not a third world country. Why did he get angry with you?
He got angry at me because I think he felt it was cowardly of me to say I would not go back to face a trial in another country that I knew that I wasn't guilty about. You know, that I knew
yeah,
I was innocent.
No. I mean, the thing is, with Schengen and EU, there's a possibility that you could be in Germany and you know, you they pull your name up. I got stopped twice in Germany by cops, one on a book tour and then once with Oxbow. And the cops were unfailingly nice, you know, that I didn't have any problems. But they did check your name through the computer. You know, guys, so Lamb of God is never going to play anywhere in an EU country again because this thing hanging over. And I mean, fundamentally, I would feel... If I feel innocent, I would proclaim that recently I watched this debate with Trump and they're talking about the Central Park Five, and he was like, oh, they pled guilty, you know, he's talking about the full page ad Trump put out for calling on him for the death penalty. He goes, well, they pled guilty. And then they pled not guilty. Like it was, and I was disappointed that Kamala didn't say, yeah. But the guy who actually committed the brutal rape of the Wall Street jogger confessed, and the DNA, he's in prison now. I think he may have been dead already, but the DNA supported his confession. So even after you knew that the science had proven that it was somebody else, you still wanted to kill these five kids who were beaten into false confessions. And I remember saying to myself at the time, I don't care what kind of pressure you bring to bear on me, you know, like torture wise, if I didn't do it, I'm not going to say I did it. You just, you know what, you take me, put me in the hospital, do whatever you got to do. But, you know, the Bad Brains song, We Will Not, it echoes in my head. You know, we will not do what they want to do, what they say. I'm not going to do it. So I think if I felt like Randy that I didn't do it, I'm glad to go to your court. I'm glad to use a public defender. You know, I'm glad to, you want to arrest me and put me in jail as a political prisoner of conscience, I'm glad to take that ride too, but I'm not going to confess to some bullshit and I'm not going to pay for some shakedown. So, you know.
I guess my opinion, I mean, you know, I've been an attorney about 17 years now, and you know, the right guy in a civil case doesn't always win. The not guilty defendant isn't always found not guilty, you know? So that's, I would just be scared to go back, and it feels like a setup to me. But anyways, let's
well, you know, I went to jail for 8 hours once, and for a moped violation, and it demystified the place for me. You know, like a friend of mine, he actually went to San Quentin out here for something serious. And he said he was scared to death. And he's walking through the yard his first day. And somebody was like, yo, Jimmy. And he looks up and he's like, eight of his friends were in there already. You know, he just assumed it was a skateboard community. He just assumed he wasn't seeing them anymore. He didn't know that they got convicted of some shit and were in San Quentin. So, you know, prison, you could be demystified. If you're not an ass, you can make it through prison, you know.
Well, and Eugene's memoir that we discussed earlier has Eugene's conflict with parking enforcement, which is one of the funnier portions of the book, and it's real good. Eugene, speaking of illegal activity, drug burn, Eugene, is this about a real story, or what's the idea behind Drug Burn here, one of the other singles off the new album?
Oh, man, he's on YouTube now. He did a podcast right after he got out. But one of my friends had been like pretty much the crystal meth king of Oklahoma, which is strange because he's not from Oklahoma, but he's a cat I used to bounce with in California. And he got busted, and, you know, dude's a man. They wanted him to roll over, and the feds wanted him to roll over on people. He's like, nope. And they were like, all right, we're going to push for 20 years. And he was like, do what you got to do. So they convicted him, and he got sentenced to 17 years. He got out 14 years with good behavior, and he called. I think I was the first person he called when he got out, and he was. It made me kind of nervous because he was talking kind of reckless about shit he and I used to do back in the day. I was like, hey, buddy, it's for that screenplay we're working on, right? So. He said that in an interesting way. He said prison was the best thing that ever happened to him. And you could actually really hear it in his voice. His name is Tony Collins. And you check out there's a YouTube interview with him where he talks right after he got out as well. Fascinating story, but you can hear it in his voice 100% that prison made him fundamentally a better person. And so this was kind of an amalgam of, you know, his thing. And I used to be friends with known associates with the guy who was the head of the San Jose Hells Angels, Steve Tawson, who got shot at a Hells Angels funeral, actually. But one of their big tenants was no drug burns. And I always thought that was kind of funny that they actually had that as codified as one of their rules. A friend of mine runs another 1% motorcycle club, and one of their bylaws is no cake in the clubhouse.
It's like, cake? You mean like little cake? Like dessert cake?
Yeah, cake, man. And I look, I go, what? And he goes, yeah, man, no cake. I go, why can't you have cake in the clubhouse? He goes, because every fucking time there's a cake in the clubhouse, there's a fist fight. I was like, Jesus Christ. You know, you think of like 1% biker gangs. I'm sure you think of everything, but no cake in the clubhouse? He's like, no, man, I'm not. That's not even a joke. Don't bring any fucking cake in the clubhouse. I was like, all right, okay. I used to ref. They had fights there periodically, and I used to ref the fights for them. So
I love how Eugene casually mentions that he used to ref fights in elite and 1% or biker clubhouses. Like, no matter how deep you dig into Eugene, there's always more to go. And you could say, John, that he's just BSing. But I know he's not, because I've seen pictures of him with Andy Warhol. He's on the back of SSD's first album. There's documentation of pretty much every single one of Eugene's wild stories, which is why he's one of the most fascinating guys ever. And
yeah, it was funny. It's funny. Somebody in the memoir was like threatening to sue me, you know. And I go, well, you know, I didn't slander you. I didn't defame you. Truth is my defense. And if you really want to push it, I got video. And that kind of quieted things down. You know, so.
Well, speaking of things that aren't quiet, Mantitude, the new Boonwell record. It's great. It's out via Skingraft and Overdrive. And October 25, and you definitely should check it out, and definitely go get it, and it's super cool. Eugene, any closing words? Anything you want people to check out with regards to Buñuel or any of your other projects, or anything in the past, or anything in the future? What do you want people to do? That's the question.
Well, the thing that I'm most excited about, and this is my first public ask for it, like it's serious deal. So you know, first Whipping Boy record, Sound of No Hands Clapping. You know, Hardcore Extravaganza, like 18 songs on it. It is, you know, stands as for the historical record. Klaus Fluorite was kind of the secondary producer on that one. He did our Not So Quiet in the Western Front cut, the Maximum Rock and Roll Hardcore compilation. But then we got really strange in the second Whipping Boy record, not hardcore at all, called Muru Muru. And we thought, yeah, you know what? I could understand that people expected hardcore. It's like I go to a grocery store, I buy toilet paper, it's sandpaper, and I'm pissed off. I understand that. So Muru Muru was not hardcore at all. People expected a hardcore record. They didn't get it. They hated it. But it was a great record, right? So it's bugged us for years and years. And finally, Steve Ballinger, the founding guitar player of Whipping Boy, we said, let's remix it. Let's see. Let's ask Ciccarelli if he'll leave it. Ciccarelli, so we had to find the original 2-inch track tapes. We had to find a baker. I don't know if you know this, but if really old tapes like this, you have to bake them in an oven before. And there's a woman who specializes in baking old tapes. We had to find her. She had to bake the tapes. Then we had to have them imported into Pro Tools sessions and then sent to Ciccarelli. And he's remixed it. And it sounds, oh my God, it sounds phenomenal. We just intended to do one song off the record. We did, I think, all except for one song on the record. And then we were just thinking, oh, just let's leave it for fun. We'll just put it up on Bandcamp. But it sounds so good that we want to find a label to release it. And I'm mentioning it now. I haven't even gotten to Skingraft with it. I'm going to do that later on today. But, you know, if there's a label, and somebody, Aaron, who just killed Sieg Records, said you should talk to the guys at Iron Lung. But I go to Iron Lung's page, and it's largely hardcore. I don't want to make that mistake again. So I need to find a label that does weird music, but not strictly hardcore. But any label that's interested in this, we just give it to you. We just want somebody to do the grunt work and put it out. But it's great. I'm so excited to have the songs actually sound like we intended them to sound. You know, it's. And I got to call Klaus, too. Klaus Florid, the bass player for the Dead Kennedys, produced it. So I want to talk to him about it just so, you know, I don't want to hurt his feelings. But, I, you know, there's a reason people remix. You know, no, there's a reason you remix things. And I don't want him. I mean, we liked what he did at the time and it was fine. But we really, over the course of time, as we learned more about music, we would have done a lot of things different. And that's what we just did. So that's what I'm super excited about.
Well, that does sound exciting. Eugene, we'll have to have you back on when you go on tour with in the USA, or maybe when the Reese Whipping Boy record comes out. You always have cool projects in the works. So Eugene, thanks again for coming on. The new album by Boonwell, Mantitude, out October 25, is Skingraft and Overdrive. And we already played two songs from that, which are out right now, but we're going to close this off with a archival Eugene track. And of course, everyone is now well acquainted with the flag versus black flag battle and the decline of Greg Ginn and current version of Black Flag. And also, I guess, the end of Off and the re-rise of the Circle Jerks and that whole mix. Little do people know that Eugene was kind of the genesis of all of that, in that he and Chuck Dukowski were going to be in a band called Blackface, which also, I believe, yeah, Milo, which is, I believe, Dukowski's stepson, and Tom yes. Dobrov was also on the record as well. They were going to do a band called Blackface, which was the unrecorded Chuck Dukowski songs from Black Flag. And, of course, Dukowski was unceremoniously fired from Black Flag after the 1982 demos, but before the My War album. So anyways, yep. Eugene and Chuck recorded two tracks, one, and that came out in 2011 on Hydra Head. One was I Want to Kill You, and the other was Monster. We're going to ride this on out with I Want to Kill You by Blackface, Eugene and Chuck Dukowski. And Eugene, thanks again, and we will see you all next week.